You know, we've been looking at this series in Micah 6:8, and what does it mean, or what can I do? And the charge is to act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. And today we're going to be looking at that last part of that, to walk humbly with your God. What does that mean? What does that mean for us? How do I live that out? I'm going to start by kind of confessing to you, humbly is not something that comes easy to me. Most of my life, I have battled with pride. I have battled with the fight to make it my way. I have worshiped at the altar of being right above all else, and even over relationships. And it has caused me tremendous pain over the years. And God got a hold of my heart and changed that in me, probably about 7-8 years ago. And now I don't look to be right. Actually, being right isn't even that high a priority for me, as it used to be a driving engine for me. So what I share with you from Walk Humbly isn't going to be necessarily from my experiences. I'm still learning to walk on those new legs, but rather what the Word of God says, and more importantly, how Jesus lived that out. In the Old Testament, humbly or humility is in 66 verses, I found. In the New Testament, there's another 25 verses. So that means the idea of humility, humbleness, humbly, humble, is in the Bible in 91 verses. Think there's a point to that? I do. Most of the time in the Old Testament, humble is talking about being made low or being subdued. Underneath the conquering king, they'll talk about you've been humbled. Underneath God the Father, our king, they'll talk about I've been made humble. David talks a lot about humility, about humbleness. But one of the most known is in 2 Chronicles 7. And right now, it's getting a lot of play out there. But it's important to understand the context of any verse. And for any verse that's kind of making its way around in memes out there, we need to look at the context. And we need to make sure also that nothing's been edited out of it. So in 2 Chronicles 7, Solomon has just finished building God's temple. Remember, David, who wanted to build God's temple and had a passion for it, was told by God, no, you can't do that. Your son will. So Solomon takes on that task, and he builds the temple, and it's there. And in chapter 6, he prays a prayer of dedication to the temple, inviting God's presence to inhabit his house and pleading for God to hear our prayers. And then in chapter 7, God responds. And he responds in this way. If my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray, seek my face, turn from their wicked ways, I will hear from heaven, I will forgive their sin, and heal their land. Now my eyes will be open, my ears attentive to the prayers offered in this place. Now, first off, I've seen that talked about. Bryce, can you go back to that slide? I want to leave that up for a little bit. The first thing it says, if. God is saying, if my people will do these things. Then it says, will humble themselves. It all starts with humble themselves. One of the versions is making its way around, and I don't know if it's by chance or not by chance, leaves that part out. Now, there is a translation out there that doesn't mention that, but that's an important part. It starts with humble themselves. It doesn't start with pray for your country, for your land. It starts with humbling ourselves to make us ready to pray. And to make us ready and in our prayer to seek his face and to turn from their wicked ways. There's a whole bunch of things in there. It doesn't just say, pray and I will heal. There's a lot more there. And so I wanted you to see that. Here's the thing. Humility comes first because it sets the attitude of the one praying. I believe God's saying, if my people will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, if I know they're humble and they come to me, they have the right attitude. I don't need to break them of anything. I don't need to subdue or lower them. They're doing it themselves. There's two other places that I want to point out. Hannah's prayer in 1 Samuel 2, after she gives over Samuel, her son that she had prayed for, to the temple, she says, the Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. And David likewise says, God saves the humble, but your eyes are on the haughty to bring them low. He saves or redeems or rescues the humble. He lowers the haughty. But here's the thing. It's something that God does to correct us, to train us, to test us. In Deuteronomy, it actually says that the whole idea of manna coming down was to test the people. Would they rest in their faith in God to provide? God makes us humble to remind us of our position and his power. Our position being under him and his power overall. You could flip those words too. God makes us humble to remind us of his position overall and our power, which is very small. The point is, God's in control. It's his plan. It's his path. It's his way. But this passage in Micah is different. It talks about walking humbly with your God. It's a charge to walk with your God. And in the Bible, where there's a charge, where there's a challenge, there's a choice. We have a choice to obey what God's saying, to obey what the prophets are saying, to follow or to disobey, and to reject what God's saying to us. And within this idea of walking humbly with your God, we see a challenge or a choice to make. Who is your God? It says, with your God. Who is your God? Are you walking with him? It's a choice, walking with your God. And then finally, are you doing so in humility? Within that very simple phrase, walking humbly with our God, are three choices that we have to make as Christians. To walk humbly is a choice that sets your attitude in your relationships. I can use my power, my authority, my position in certain situations to rule over, to have my say. In the days when I was younger, to force my way, to put forth my thoughts, sometimes just by being louder than everybody else, to push my belief on others. Or I can choose to walk humbly and to let God have his way, submit to using his power to guide my actions and my words. It's a choice. But we have a model. All throughout this, we've been looking at, we have a model, one who knows us, one who was tempted and feels everything that we feel, because he was like us. And so what we're going to look at is the model of Jesus in John 13. So turn in John 13, and we're going to go through this story, starting right in the first verse. So it was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew the hour had come for him to leave the world and to go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Now get this. Jesus knew the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returned. Jesus was being prepared to return to the Father. to go back. The verse here says, he knew everything was in his power. That God had put everything in his power. And he knew he was here only for a short time, that he was headed back home to return to the Father, to sit with God on the throne. His time on earth as a person born in a manger, wandering around, trying to show people a better way to love God, a better way to love others, a better way to live, that time was ending. Time to wrap it up. Time to get out and go back to ruling with the Father over mankind. Now, if that's me, my patience is running thin. My patience in dealing with these stubborn people set in their ways. My patience with a temple system that was meant to honor my Father no longer even represents God's love, God's kindness, God's forgiveness. Jesus saved his harshest words, not for the lost, but for those that were so steeped in religion, they had lost the heart of the Father. And so if I'm Jesus at that point, I just want to get things done. I just want to move on. But it says Jesus loved his own who were in this world until the end. The difference is that statement. It's the love that was in him for God's people. Jesus was a shepherd until the very end, caring for his sheep. You know, a couple of years ago, I lost suddenly in my family, my siblings, and my mom lost suddenly my eldest brother, who had had a heart attack and collapsed and was taken from us within a very short time, leaving behind a wife and three kids and us as siblings and his mom and a church that he oversaw. It was the week after Easter, 2 years ago, and so his last message was Easter. How appropriate is that? His last message was about hope. If you knew him, that was very appropriate. But as he was taken, and then we're trying to come to grips with all this, trying to understand all this, and I was asked to speak at his service at his church. And I shared with the person that they knew and that our siblings knew as Pastor Richard was not the person I grew up with. And I showed a picture of all of us as we were very young, growing up. He was the eldest of six, where I had superimposed a crown on him because I said, well, the person I grew up with was King Richard. It wasn't Pastor Richard. But the change was Jesus got a hold of his heart. And the impact my brother had very little to do with being a phenomenal leader of men and people, had very little to do with being an amazing teacher of the word. It had everything to do with him being a loving, caring shepherd. And at his service, before that, as the people are coming in, and I was able to greet and hear the stories of how he impacted their lives, they were lined around the building in that church, which is a bigger church. It was a church of about 600 people in regular attendance, could not hold, with all their overflow rooms, the impact of one shepherd. That's a man. Think about how Jesus shepherded. How Jesus cared and the impact that that had. It was his love for his people that continued to guide his actions up until Jesus's final days. So we continue. So he got up from the meal, he took off his outer clothing, and he wrapped a towel around his waist. And after that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him. Now, I read a commentary on this that said that at that kind of formal dinner, someone should have been there, a servant should have been there to wash the guests' feet. Remember, this was the time of sandals or no sandals. People's feet were filthy before you came inside. It wasn't just as a serving. It was a common courtesy to have your feet washed. But that person wasn't there. The apostles clearly would have known that that person wasn't there. But none of them offered to help. None of them offered a solution. But Jesus did. You see, Jesus took the place of the servant. He took off his robe. He lowered himself down onto his knees to do the task none of them wanted to do. That's serving. That's humility. Previously, it said he knew all of God's power was within him. He chose to put that aside, down on his knees, and to serve and care and love those people. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." Peter says, "No, you shall never wash my feet." And Jesus says, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." Jesus is making a point here, saying, if you want to follow me, you have to let me serve you. You have to let me show you how to serve. Jesus sacrificed his position for them. Jesus was serving them. Jesus was setting the example for them. That all those times where he talked about the first will be last, the last will be first. Blessed are the peacemakers. All those times that he talked about loving and dying for oneself, he meant it. So he lived it. And in these last days, he was going to show that to those that were closest, were following him the closest. Peter needed to get on board. Jesus knew that. God had special plans for Peter. We see that he was chosen to lead and to build Jesus' church, to open up his church beyond just the Jews, which were thought of as in the temple and could go most places in the temple, to the Gentiles, to everyone. Time was short. Peter needed to be put on an accelerated learning curve, and Jesus knew that. Then the Lord, Simon Peter replied, "Not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Peter, in his rambunctious style, his passion first, go, go, go style, said, "Fine, if that's what it means to follow you, wash all of me. My head, my hands, wash it all." Jesus answered, "Those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean. And you are clean." Jesus is saying, "No, Peter, you're clean because you're mine. It's just your feet that need to be washed." He goes on and he says, "Though not every one of you," he says, "you're clean, but not every one of you, for he knew who was going to betray him." And that was why he said, "Not everyone was clean." And when he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" He asked. "It's time for a lesson." He's saying, "Do you know why I did this?" I can imagine that the apostles at this point would be fumbling over themselves and thinking, he's going to ask us about this. He's going to ask us about this. What do we need to say? What about this? But then he cuts them short and he lowers the boom because he wasn't really asking. He was just setting up so that they would hear. And he says, "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord, and your teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set for you an example that you should do as I have done for you." That's the lesson. You should also wash one another's feet. You should also serve one another. Follow my example. And to bring it home, he says, "Very truly, I tell you." My seminary professor says, whenever you see "truly, truly," or "very truly," or "verily," he's saying, get this. This is important. I'm repeating myself. Understand. Watch this. Watch this, he says. "No servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Folks, that's discipleship. What he's saying is, you've seen me do it. You've learned and I've taught you why I do it. So you now know it clicks. You understand why I do it. So now, go do it and be blessed. That's discipleship. You see, discipleship may start in learning and knowing, but it must grow into doing, into showing love, into serving each other, into acting justly, into loving mercy. We must not stop at knowing or always feeling like we need to learn more. See, that's the trap. If before we do it, we always need to learn more, we're going to delay it and delay it and delay it. We must not stop at knowing before we do it. Andy Stanley has this idea that he always is talking about. He says, listen, I may know a lot about something, I may have a lot of experience, or I may have only a little bit of experience. But what I do is I pour it in a cup. And so everything I've got is in this cup. My goal is not to fill up my cup before I pour it out. My purpose is whatever's in my cup, whatever I have at that time, when someone needs it, to pour it out, whether it's little or whether it's a lot. Don't wait until your cup is full or you feel your cup is full before you pour it out and show love and serve others and reach out to others and share with others. We're called to be his hands and his feet. It doesn't say we're to be his brains and his lips. It's not just about knowing and telling people I know it. How am I showing it? A church that only learns and talks about it, usually with each other, is not an active, healthy expression of Jesus' church, of Jesus' bride, and therefore will not make the impact that the gospel's meant to make. The church is the carrier, not just the building, not just the local expressions, all of Christ's body. All who have professed, I know who you are, and I want you to be my Savior and my Lord. And it starts with walking humbly with our God. When I look at this passage, I feel like it's actually upside down. That it starts with walking humbly. Then it goes to loving mercy. And then finally doing justice or acting justly. But it's the foundation. It starts with having a servant's attitude with friends and foes. Now, why do I say that? Here's why. Judas was there. There are two references to Judas being there at that time. It first says the meal was in progress. The devil had already prompted Judas to betray Jesus. So it's referencing him. And then later, when he says to Peter, you're clean, though not all of you are clean, it goes on and says, for he knew who was going to betray him. And that was why he said not everyone was clean. Later on, we learn that he turns to Judas near the end of the supper and says, go do what you're going to do. Judas was there. What does that mean? Judas got his feet washed too. Even if you couldn't read, he couldn't read between the lines and know that Jesus was talking about him, though I truly believe he could, though the rest of the apostles probably didn't get it. Jesus washed Judas's feet. How different would our conversations be with those who don't think like us? First, if they were in person, it's easy to hide in social media. Make the tough conversations in person. And second, though I know it's not our culture, but if we're washing each other's feet, I know it's not our culture, so I'm not saying go and wash everybody's feet and all your foes and when you have these difficult conversations and things you disagree with, but what's the corollary to serving someone as you have difficult conversation? Let's just go with the washing the feet first. I'm a Mets fan. Most of you are Phillies fans, right? So instead of, wow, I can't believe you guys did this. What is wrong with your team? What is going on? I'm washing your feet. I'm listening. I've lowered myself. I'm no longer standing up and saying, this is right. This is right. What your team needs to do is this, and they're never going to be any good. Which is a Mets fan, I would never say, especially these days. But anyway, what about politics? What if instead of standing up and standing bold and standing angry and proclaiming and shouting out, we got down? We lowered ourselves on the difficult conversations to listen, to hear, to understand social issues, discrimination. Listen, whenever you see someone very, very agitated about something, there is fear and there is usually pain. You don't confront fear with anger or pride. And you surely don't heal pain with anger or pride. It gets done from a servant's heart. It gets done with a humble heart. To walk humbly with your God is to walk humbly with your neighbor. You might not agree, but show love and kindness and compassion. They may not see things the same way as you, but show love and kindness and compassion. They may resent you and what they think you stand for, but show love and kindness and compassion. The reason I say what they think you stand for is because as a Christian, may we stand for Jesus above all else. not standing for this issue above all else. This issue hurts people. So we talked about giving forgiveness, showing compassion. But I'm standing for Jesus. Would it hurt Jesus? Yeah. Well, then I need to stand for it. He says, if I have set an example that you should do as I have done for you, he says that at the end, then very truly I tell you, no servant is greater than his master. I have set for you an example. No servant is greater than his master. It's your choice. Will you follow the Lord's lead, your Lord's lead? Will you let him live and empower you so that you can act justly to build unity where all around us people are looking to divide, 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 usually to extend their own power? Will you love mercy? To show forgiveness, it can be done by walking humbly with your God. That's the challenge. That's the charge. Will we do that? If we do that as a church, the new season that we're moving into, the blessings that can come from us and come through us are unlimited. The impact we can make by loving, 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 by fighting for unity, by standing for Jesus above all other things, could be powerful. I said last week when I said we're looking to regather on October 8th, that it will never be the same, but it could be better. If the church, the Big C Church, and our local expression of the church builds unity by acting justly, shows forgiveness and loves mercy, and walks humbly with our God, there's no telling what God could do with us individually and us together. May that be so.